Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
She knew absolutely how much she was loved, but actually it's a harsh reality that it actually isn't enough. Love isn't enough. Love doesn't save them.
Now, what for you are those other things, those barriers that we need to bring down before we can have a more sort of enlightened conversation about how do we best care for young people?
It's unbelievable that this whole sector doesn't have a legal duty of care. And it's not a duty of care because they can say, you know, it's safety and wellbeing, but unless it's legal, it's not really good enough.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. We're back for another week. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Wherever you're listening, you are more than welcome to join us each and every week. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've got a really great guest on the programme this week, and it was an absolute delight to spend some time with someone who's really passionate about a new campaign, but for very, very personal reasons, as we will hear in the next few moments. Our guest this week is Hilary Grime. Now, Hilary's daughter, Phoebe, took her own life at university, sadly, in June of 2021, and she'd moved up to Newcastle from Kent to study philosophy at the Newcastle University. But as I pointed out, sadly, she died by suicide. She took her life, and the family, of course, have had to deal with the repercussions for that personally, but also they've looked at some of the wider issues, because you may be aware that student suicides have become a really big talking point off the back of a couple of inquests. And in different parts of the country, families are demanding answers and trying to find out what happened to their child. And of course, that's a clear and obvious thing that you would do as a parent. But of course, when it's a university, there's of course a structure in place that you're sending your child away to, if you like. And I'll call them a child, although 18 years of age, of course, when you move to university. But if you're sending your child to a different part of the country, of course, you want to know that they are safe, that they are being looked after, and that frameworks and structures are in place. You may have heard about the idea of Harry's Law, that universities need to declare how many students within their cohort are dying by suicide each year, so that information becomes within the public domain. But now calls for a legal duty of care to be introduced so that there is that responsibility that the universities have to take towards their students. That's the focus of Hillary's campaign. There is a petition which is up and running. At the time of speaking, there is around about 6,500 signatures to that petition. There is a link as well to the petition in the notes for the podcast. But she's really passionate about making sure that the responsibility lies with universities to make sure that those frameworks are in place, and that is across the board. So it's not just that one university likes to do a good thing, or one university has found something that works for them. All universities have the same standards, so that all parents and all students know that there is a standardized system across the board. Now, at the end of the podcast, you will hear two statements, one from Universities UK about the general guidance offered to university about how best to support young people with their mental health while they are students. You'll also hear a statement from Newcastle University, which was the university that Phoebe attended. Now, the coroner in Phoebe's inquest found nothing more could have been done to help her on behalf of the university. And the university are clear to say that they are never complacent and continuously working to improve the services and support they provide students, and have been looking again at their policies and processes. Those two statements in full, you will be able to hear at the end of this conversation. Now, like I said, there's a lot in this conversation around suicide. Of course, that is the nature of the conversation this week, but I wanted to flag that up right at the start. Hilary is a fantastic guest. She's so open and honest about her own journey. She started off by telling me about Phoebe.
So Phoebe, I'm hugely proud of Phoebe. She was everything that anyone would want in a daughter. She's the youngest of, she's got two older brothers. So obviously I was absolutely delighted to have a daughter when she was born. She was great fun, very sporty, intelligent. She went on to she got a posthumous degree from Newcastle for philosophy, which she was very passionate about. Phoebe was really kind and compassionate, and struggled with how things out there in the big wide world were often cruel, or people weren't just or kind. I think that was sort of like quite a problem for her. So she was really giving and really thoughtful. She was a really special person. So one of the things was that before Phoebe died, she had signed up twice to the NHS blood and organ donors, because she said that, if she died, she wanted her organs to be used to save lives. And that's just a complete example of the sort of person that she was, always thinking about other people, and very sort of philosophical about it. So she did agree before she died, well, we gave six of her main organs to other people who are whose lives she saved and who are living today. And I've had letters from a few of them, some heartrending letters that call her angel. And she's absolutely my angel as well.
It's an incredible legacy that she's left, and maybe testament to, the attitude that she had in terms of wanting to help and support people. In terms of her mental health, at what point were you aware that she was struggling, or that things maybe weren't going so well for her from a mental health point of view?
She found Newcastle Uni very difficult from the beginning. She was sort of with a group of people that she didn't really identify with. And one of the things that I also feel quite strongly about is sort of, she got there in September, and then within a month they were having to decide their accommodation for the following year. Well, a month in, you haven't met many people. So there's sort of like a lot of pressure on students to hurry up and sign up. So she signed up for a house with people that, as I say, weren't like-minded, which sort of was not great for her. Also, she had lockdown, so she found her way through ice hockey and surfing. So both sort of pretty dramatic sports, which she absolutely loved and were her saving grace. So when lockdown happened, and she couldn't do the sports, and she was stuck in her room, that's sort of when the problems really started. I knew that she was depressed. I knew that she was struggling. I didn't know at all to the extent that she was struggling. Unbelievably, Newcastle University have a 168-page timeline on Phoebe, which I didn't realise, and they knew exactly what was happening with her and how much she was struggling. I did ring them, and they have it reported in their timeline that they've recorded my phone number, they're going to pass it on to the ops team, and if there are any problems, they would ring me, but they never rung me.
Was that because Phoebe had reached out to support services within the university to ask for help at that point?
So she was having her six counselling sessions. So in October 2020, she had her counselling sessions. That was a really tough time for her. She told the counsellors that she had already had a suicide plan, and they knew about it, but she was only allowed six sessions. And in January 2021, she sent them an email, again recorded by them. I didn't know this, saying, please, please help me. She had a counselling session from the university 20 hours before she took her life. But for me, the counselling session that she had, which I have notes on, wasn't anywhere near what it should have been to help her in what she needed. Phoebe needed hope. She'd lost all hope. She couldn't see a way out. And for me, that counselling session, as I say, his notes definitely didn't provide that. So, yeah, that's another issue.
And that sort of leads us on to where your campaign is looking at now. And you mentioned there the idea that you'd rung and said, call me if I need to, have information, or there's things that I need to know. You're calling for the government to essentially change the law so that relationship changes. Now, let's just sort of frame this a little bit in regard to the fact that when you go to university, you're 18 years of age. So the law sees you as
an adult, and with that comes, you know, the duty of care falls on you as a, as an individual. But I mean, I've been to university. I've also been an 18-year-old, and I also know that although you might have that tick on, you know, a form which now says you're an adult, that actually there's still a very strong reliance financially, emotionally, and otherwise upon that sort of family unit. And your parents are still obviously a huge, huge part of your life at that point.
For me, you know, Phoebe was a long way away. I live in Kent. She was in Newcastle. You know, gosh, of course, I've got so many what ifs, but if I had my time again, I wouldn't have sent her so far away. I think that the problem is that, you know, I feel very naive now. I trusted the university. They say in their mental health charter that the safety and well-being of students is their priority. And you think that she's having counselling and, you know, that they're on it. But at the inquest, the administrator for the university stood up and said under oath that their counselling is normally for issues such as relationship problems and homesickness. And then after that, I was ignorant about them not having a duty, students not having a duty of care. And then when it all sort of revealed that there is no legal duty of care at university, but there is for their staff, there is an underemployment law, there is for people in prisons, there is for those in their education. But this whole band of a very, very vulnerable group of people, as you say, you know, have left home for the first time, you know, they've got to try and find their boundaries, you know, make new friends. They've got work pressures. I think that the study pressure seems to be harder now for those at uni than it was when I was at university. There is no legal duty of care. So why it needs to be a legal duty of care is so that it's a clarity for not just the students, but for the staff. I mean, it must be awful being the staff at university, and different universities are doing different things, and you don't really know, you know, there's not sort of like a fundamental benchmark or framework for students, staff, or the families. And the result of that is that different universities are doing different things. There's some things that, you know, like Bristol, I think, is doing something really good at the moment. They've got a policy when their opt-in policy is such that they are ringing parents if they're worried. So last year they rang 96 parents. And I think that is just incredible. 96 parents, because they were concerned about their children. I think, gosh, if somebody had phoned me or, you know, you can read about people, you know, like, you know, last week there was somebody that wasn't phoned, his parents were ringing. That would have, you know, possibly saved, you know, definitely. Well, if they'd have rung me, I would have been in that car. But not all universities are doing the same thing. So it just needs to be clear, and they need to be accountable for it, and they need to really step up and sort it out, because there's one student takes their life every 4 or 5 days. You know, it's desperate. And obviously, you know, my life is completely, well, I could say my life's ruined, but it's hugely affected everybody else in our family, Phoebe's friends, my friends, and the community which I live in. It's massive. The repercussions of this are huge. So, and it's really urgent. And it's unbelievable that this whole sector doesn't have a legal duty of care. And it's not a duty of care, because they can say, you know, they can say, well, you know, it's safety and well-being, but unless it's legal, it's not really good enough. Every person who's lost a child at university, who's taken their life, has got different issues and different situations. You know, we're all unique. So that's why it needs to be an overall. So the counselling that Phoebe had, I don't believe was good enough, but and I believe that could have saved her life as well if she had the right. But that's not the same for everybody else. Everyone's got different issues. Because universities don't want to record the suicides, there's not enough learning from what's happened. They want to brush it under the carpet, whereas if there was sort of like a no-blame culture, we could look and go, what happened? Where did it go wrong? How are we going to learn from this to make sure that this doesn't happen to the next? I'm calling them child, but they're still, for me, children at that age. I don't think you become real adults until you're about 25, but I mean, that's a controversial point of view. But yeah, to learn from what's happened.
Do you understand their position when they're sort of saying, well, these were the rules and this was the system that we had in place, or these were the structures within what they were operating, if you like?
That's why it's quite tough for the staff. That's why I would have thought if you're working, if you're a staff member in your university, you know, you need the correct, you know, clear procedures and structures to know exactly what to do. So I think it's hard for them. I think that they've been told that they can only give 6 sessions every 6 months. You know, in many ways, it's not their fault. They don't have it all there. I mean, I think they probably do the best with the tools that they have. Of course, they don't want students to take their life. Of course, they don't want that.
If there had been a system in place there whereby somewhere along that sort of pathway that they follow, there was a note that said, call the designated adult, in which case it would have been you, but I imagine people might be able to recommend somebody else if they don't maybe have a relationship with their parents or whatever it would be, that you would have a designated call. That call would then come in, allowing families to almost create their own action around a young person, and that might be bringing them home, or it might be moving up there, or whatever it would be. Do you get a sense from the families that you speak to that involvement at that moment of the wider family would have a huge impact around what that young person's experience is?
You know, absolutely huge. And if I'd have known, you know, what Phoebe was telling them, it's heartbreaking for me that I didn't. So that would have been a major difference. But it's not just ringing the parents. It's, you know, when the counsellors see them, you know, they need to act on that as well. You know, they need to contact the doctor. You know, they asked Phoebe if she was in touch with the doctor and she just said yes, but actually she wasn't. They need to make sure that these things are happening, and they need to encourage the student as well to reach out to their family and friends and really tell them what's happening. It's all sorts of things that they need to be doing, but of course ringing your parents is so important.
I guess when any death by suicide, people ask questions about if I'd have known, or if I ever had more information, I could have done X, Y, or Z. What was it like for you as a parent then to see that actually some of that information was in, it's not in the public domain, but was in a domain where other people could see it, which would have offered clues? You mentioned before the idea that she'd mentioned the idea of a suicide plan, you know, that was in place. How was it for you becoming aware that information existed and that someone else had heard that information, but you as a parent hadn't heard that information?
I was absolutely gutted. Really, really hard to read. And, you know, 20 hours before she died, she told the counsellor that she put her hand on her heart and wished the pain to end. As I say, it's really, really difficult to live with. But it makes me... You know, like Phoebe saved her 6 lives through her donations, organ donations. My reason for being and my purpose for being here, of course, other than my 2 sons, is to try and make a change and make a difference so that we can give the proper support to those uni students that desperately need it. You know, the numbers are rising, mental health problems in universities, so that we can help and support the ones and also try and save lives and make sure that no more university students take their life. And that is, you know, the only thing I can do now, which is what Phoebe would want me to do. As you know, you might see her recording or hear her recording. I found the recording after she died. She was on a separate Instagram account, which I didn't realize. I was merrily following another one until her friends came around and asked me if I'd seen it, and I hadn't seen it. And, you know, to see Phoebe speaking in her room, she was just speaking to her handful of friends. But it was almost like she was speaking to everybody, like, do you know how hard it is to get help? Really, and I feel like I'm going to be her voice to carry that on, with her very much living inside me. And she's saying to me, come on, Mum, save more people, do this. And so I'm going to do this, keep on doing this if it's the very last thing I do. But it's hard to make change at such institutions.
Now, what for you are those other things, those barriers that we need to bring down before we can have a more sort of enlightened conversation about how do we best care for young people?
Well, I think the sort of the main barrier is that, you know, the universities themselves, who don't record deaths by suicide, they don't want to do that. And also, I guess, but until they do that and they acknowledge it and acknowledge it's a problem and it really, really needs to change, you know, I can't see it's going to happen. But of course, they don't want a legal duty of care. So I think that the universities themselves don't want it. I mean, to be fair, some universities are trying hard, definitely, to put things in place. You know, absolutely they are. But some universities, they're all doing different things. There isn't sort of like a set of framework for everyone. And what they need is the 168, you know, higher education institutions all need to be doing, following the same plan, so that wherever you send your child, whatever university they're at, they're getting the same standard of clarity and care for their students. I think sort of one of the big things that they might fear is cost, but actually a lot of the framework was there. For example, as I said, you know, Phoebe's timeline, they recorded it all. It was all there. You know, I think that's just something to hide behind about how much extra it's going to cost. Yeah, okay, you need to employ more people to make sure that there is information sharing within the universities. So that was quite a big one for me, that they should have done that. And that maybe the standard of counselling for me needs to be improved. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I think that's just an excuse, especially given the fees that what they're paying and the interest that they're paying afterwards, what they're paying, like ridiculous, more than 6%, I think, on their fees. I mean, for goodness sake. But it's trying to get people to listen and trying to get it into Parliament and trying to make it heard is a task. There's a lot of lip service. There's a lot of like, yes, we agree. Oh, yes, we really must do something about it. And then nothing's done, or there's no progress being made. So since it's a battle.
Do you feel as well that 18, which we place the 18 years of age as the you're an adult now, you're big enough to look after yourself, and you know you don't need parental consent for things. That's obviously that's an across the board number that we just take, don't we? We take for a million and one different things. It's 18 years of age. The following day after, you know, your 17th and 364 days, that's your birthday. You're an adult now. Do you think that as a nation and legally that we put too much on that date as being significant, so as not to be able to? Well, they're 18. They're old enough to look after themselves now.
Yeah,
I don't. They don't need their parents anymore. Yeah. Do you feel like it's become this arbitrary figure? But actually, its relevance in the real world, maybe particularly when we're talking about something like this, particularly when we're talking about students who are temporarily moving away from home, but of course will be returning home, who still rely financially often on parents as well, and will continue to do for some period of time, certainly, you know, for that sort of 3-year period at university. That 18, although we'll always lean on that from a legal point of view, maybe when you look at it, doesn't fit. It doesn't fit. You wouldn't pick that date and say, yeah, they're fine. That's the point, they're leaving home, and therefore, you know, the parents are no longer a significant part of their lives. I know it not to be true, Hillary. I can tell you that. And I have to think about my last year of university and depressive moments that I went through at that time, a sense in myself that I was old enough to take care of that, or I should take care of that because I was at university. Whereas, you know, when people say, what advice would you give to your younger self? My advice would be go home, go and sleep in your own, go and sleep in your own bed. Go and have some, you know, cooked food from your mum and dad or whatever that family environment is as well. And that was just me in my circumstances, but a sense that, you know, well, you were by that point I was 20 or 21 years of age, so I should be able to deal with it myself. But I've grown up in a world where you're 18 now, get on with it. And I sense that might not change, but I wonder whether or not that might be one of the barriers that you come up against, that people will just go 18.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ideally it would be older than that, but that's never going to happen. Ideally it would be 21, I think. But even at 21, it doesn't mean, does it, that you're mature and adult. I mean, as I say, so they say that girls and boys mature at different ages, and the male mental isn't mature properly until 25. I think the female's 22. But also, I mean, to put a fixed date where people have different birthdays, don't they? So you could be like 18 and 11 months or just 18. So, and that makes a difference. But to think that everybody matures differently is just bizarre, isn't it? I mean, some people are going to be far more mature than others. Maybe people that have been to boarding school, children have been to boarding school, are a bit more resilient and a bit more able, to manage than those that have been at home, but just because everybody's 18. Yeah, it's bad. It's mad. But in America, they have a university, have a very different system. They hugely include the family in everything. They're really in touch with the family. It's not like you're 18 and off you go. So if it was 18, maybe that would be okay if they had much more contact with the family and were much more on it, you know, maybe then much more aware, maybe that would be all right. But of course, as I say, people mature at different ages. And 18 to me sounds like nothing. You know, how can you be expected at 18 to cook for yourself and to sort yourself out and, I don't know, manage everything all of a sudden? They're such a vulnerable group of society. And students need massive support and care and attention to manage that big wide world. And it, from what I can see, and a lot of other people, it's not happening at universities.
Can I ask you how often is Phoebe at the forefront of your thoughts?
Well, Phoebe is the first thing when I wake up, I open my eyes. I'm a year and a half on, and I'm like, it hasn't happened. You know, it's an absolute, it's a constant. The only thing that I can do is learn to manage it so that I, when I do go out, I can try and be brave and join in and be happy. I can try it. It's just a case of a manager, but, I think of her the whole time. I help myself by saying that she's with me in my heart, and I'm taking her with me wherever I go. But somebody said to me the other day, which I has completely resonate with, is that when something like this happens, so on the day that Phoebe died, it's like a massive glass bulletproof wall comes down, and you can see on the other side the life that you had, and you want that life back, but you can't have that life. And it's the hardest thing to try and turn away and to try and make a new life and make new paths and new memories is really, really tough, really tough. But I mean, as I say, it's helpful to try and do something worthwhile, because I know Phoebe would want that.
Does it concern you thinking that there are other parents who were in your position who don't know what's happening or what might happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's happening all the time. I met a mother who's 2 weeks ago, whose son took his life at Manchester Uni. The people just don't realise. They say we're trusting these universities with their children, and they are professing that they're on it with their safety and well-being. They don't have proper frameworks and benchmarks in place. So, yeah, I want to scream out. Don't think it's okay. And also the other thing is for me is that, all parents, I absolutely loved my children. And, I used to say to Phoebe the whole time, how much I love you. And she used to get so bored of it. She's like, fall about, oh God, Mom. And I used to say that I would do anything for you. You know, I would. And she knew that, and she knew absolutely how much she was loved. But actually, it's a harsh reality that love doesn't, it actually isn't enough. Love isn't enough. Love doesn't save them. And I always thought that was the fact that she was so well loved, and she knew that foundation, but it's not. And I think probably other parents probably think that as well. But it's not enough, because when the world for them is dark and they can't see options and they've got no hope, everything spirals out of control, and there's only one way out for them. And actually, it doesn't save them.
Which is why that framework change and those, you know, the legal change is what you're calling for. What we will do is we'll put a link to the petition in the notes for the podcast so people can sign there, calling for a legal of duty of care for students in higher education. It's more than 6,000 signatures on that so far. And hopefully we'll continue to have these conversations, share these stories and get that action.
I'm really grateful to you for listening and for doing this. It's absolutely fantastic, and well done, you, Mick. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to spend some time with Hillary, and I really appreciate her time and wish her all the best in terms of her campaigning and the campaigning work that she's doing. I will put a link to the organization that she's working with, trying to bring this change to the fore, in the link to the podcast, on the notes for the podcast. So that'll be there for you to check out. Plus, of course, that link to the petition as well, which is also up there. I've got a statement here from the Newcastle University, from their academic registrar, Lucy Backhurst. It says, "We are devastated by Phoebe's death, and I would like to once again offer my sincere condolences to her family and friends. Phoebe was a talented and popular student who had great potential, and she will be remembered fondly by all those who had the pleasure of knowing her during her time at Newcastle University. In the 18 months she studied with us, Phoebe received ongoing help, and we had been working hard to support her through her studies. A support plan was in place to help her with her academic studies, and she had a dedicated counsellor who was helping her during a very difficult time. While the coroner in Phoebe's inquest found nothing more could have been done to help her, we are never complacent and continuously work to improve the services and support we provide students, and have been looking again at our policies and processes. Like all schools, colleges and universities, we are acutely aware of the increasing number of young people needing mental health support. Working with key partners, we do our very best to support any student who is struggling with their mental health and offer a range of support options to meet their many different needs." That is the statement from the Newcastle University. I also got a statement through in regard to Universities UK, who sort of represent more than 140, I think 140 or so universities across the UK. Now, they say, they've issued guidance in regard to improving the provision for mental health support within universities, stating that universities need to have clearer policies on how and when they should involve families, carers and trusted friends when there is considered to be a serious risk to the welfare of a student. Now, they've been working with our friends at Papyrus, actually, publishing recommendations calling on universities to be more proactive in preventing student suicides. Now, the recommendations that they have set out include making it mandatory for students to give a trusted contact at registration, being clear that the contact does not have to be a parent, and starting a conversation about when and how these contacts may be involved. This is the guidance. Having check-ins as well at the start of each academic year for students to update the information and make it easier to update the contact if circumstances change. So you might want to say, "I'd rather you didn't contact my parent, but I would rather you contact my family friend," or whoever it would be that's an appropriate person. Ensuring that universities review their suicide prevention plans and policies, and making it clear that although always preferable to gain agreement from the student, where there are serious concerns about student safety or mental health, universities can decide to involve trusted contacts without agreement. Now, to me, this seems like a positive step forward, and this is only recommendation now from Universities UK. Now, I have asked for the team there to let me know how many universities have signed up to this and are taking this on board. If this is a first step, then great. If this is the best guidance that's out there, then that's great, as long as it's being used right across the board. Steve West is the president of Universities UK. He says, "There is nothing more devastating for a university community than a student death by suicide. And as a sector, we need to do everything we can to reduce the risk of suicide and serious self-harm." Jed Flynn, who's a friend of the show, chief exec of Papyrus Prevention of Young Suicide, said, "University life can be exciting, but also bewildering and frightening at times, especially when students are away from the familiar or the people and places which form part of their preferred or go-to support. Students have a right to think we always have their best interests at heart. This guidance aids the discernment
of when to put those best interests at the forefront of decisions on sharing information when emotional crises may loom larger. I'll do a web article for this whole story, which I'll put the full statements in as well, which you can read too. But thank you for checking out the podcast this week. Thank you to Hillary. We wish her all the best in terms of her campaigning and life in general, of course. And thank you for those teams who've put together those statements as well, so we could bring you that full picture as well. I think there's a lot more to move on this one as well. I'd be very keen to hear more from the Universities UK. I'd be very keen to hear more from the Universities Minister. And I'd be very keen to make sure that steps are being taken across the board for universities to take action so that there is a guarantee of quality of care for students no matter where they are across the country. That's something we'll continue to support here at Mental Health Monday, and I know you'll join us for that too.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.